Welcome to the This Is Money podcast, brought to you in partnership with Charles Stanley Direct, the award-winning investment platform trusted by over 40,000 clients. Investment involves risk. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And on the menu, the lockdown mini housing boom has left buyers battling for homes and sellers deaf to the sound of haggling. We give you some top tips on how to get your offer heard. Plus, ask, should you ever pay over the asking price? Experts say buyers beware. Elsewhere, inflation has hit a five-year low, but still only 11, yes, 11 savings accounts from our seven biggest banks can match the lowly 0.2%. Where on earth do savers turn? To trading, perhaps? We look at the rise of the lockdown share trader and ask, will it last? A victory of sorts for small businesses as the High Court tells insurers to pay out to those forced to close by coronavirus pandemic, but they could be waiting for months. And to pee or not to pee, I'm talking about coins, by the way. The Royal Mint says no more new 2p's or £2 coins to be produced for at least the next decade. Is it time again to talk about the death of cash again this week as well? We will discuss that too. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, house prices are not my favourite subject, caveat. Pretty bonkers at the best of times, but post-lockdown, buyers have gone a little bit more nuts, it seems. Despite the deluge of economic gloom and doom, prices keep soaring. Estate agents reckon it's the frantic buyers battling over spacious family homes, coastal bolt holes and rural retreats that are causing it all. Plus, of course, we've got the stamp duty holiday. That, they say, is turbocharged a housing market already buoyant after lockdown ended. But should you be willing to pay over the asking price for your dream home, or take all of this with a bit of a pinch of salt? With fears over rising unemployment and the end of stamp duty holiday, of course, that comes in March next year, experts are urging buyers to think very carefully before paying over the odds. Lee, welcome back. Briefly explain, where are we at with the housing market and why?
Georgie, I think bonkers is a pretty good way to describe it, if I'm being honest. So we've had the stamp duty holiday that came in for properties up to £500,000. That seems to have stimulated the market a little bit in recent weeks. People don't want to miss out on potentially what could be quite a big saving if they want to move home, maybe move to a different area, maybe they want to upsize, maybe they want to downsize. But the truth of the matter is, it has been quite a frantic market. There's more properties being listed for sale. People appear to be clambering over the best ones to try and buy them and try and get them. We've had data out this week from the ONS showing that in June house prices were up something like 3% in a year, which you think during lockdown just seems quite mad to hit a record high, which is interesting in itself. And all of these things are leading to questions that are being asked, such as, should you overpay for a house, go beyond what the asking price is? Are sellers pricing their homes accordingly? Are they just putting them up, say, well, do you know what, do I really want to move? Well, maybe not, but if I could get £20,000 more than potentially what I think this place is worth, let's do it. So there's that whole issue of getting estate agents over and getting it priced up and going, do you know what, let's have a punt and just stick it on the market and see what happens. Let's see if it really is a hot market at the moment. And all these sort of elements are coming into play, which means basically if you're buying in this market, there could be some danger signs there, some warning signs. And we've got one of the biggest warning signs is from the CBR that are saying next year house prices could drop 14%. But huge caveat in that, Georgie, is how it's just unpredictable market at the moment. It's just completely unpredictable. We've had all of these sort of predictions before. We've heard that property prices were going to fall something like 30% after Brexit. We heard that the coronavirus pandemic was going to hit house prices drastically this year. By the end of the year, we were going to be looking at potentially double-digit falls, percentage falls in house prices. And then we've got this again now next year that there's going to be potentially a massive bite in the property market. And that could be a symptom of things like unemployment, people not being able to afford to move, not being able to move house and buy a property. And all those sort of things are in play at the moment. And it just goes to show our obsession with property and the property market just has no boundaries, Georgie. It's just sort of, a crisis. What crisis? Property prices are still going up. That's what it feels like at the moment.
We've discussed this, Simon, in depth as to why we are here and this current situation. Lee's pointed out about property prices could go down 14%. Well, there was a prediction that the same thing would happen after Brexit, the same thing would happen after lockdown, da da da. And they keep, bonkers as they are, keep going up. So look, if you want a property and you love it and it's your dream home, why not suggest paying a little bit more?
It's like a gigantic game of whack-a-mole, isn't it? Everybody, you just keep hitting the property market, the overpriced property market, over the head, and it just keeps popping up somewhere else. I mean, there's an old saying that a house is worth what someone is willing to pay for it. So you can list it for whatever you want to list it for. The asking, you can put whatever asking price you want on your property, but it will only sell for what someone is willing to pay for it. Now, the way people end up paying more for properties than they perhaps plan to is when you end up with more than one person who's willing to pay for it, and you end up with people bidding against each other. So, for example, if you're the only person who's interested in a property and you put in an offer, the seller says it's too low, you can go up a bit maybe, but you're more in control of the situation. You're making the decision and you can decide when to walk away, and maybe you and the seller can't come to an agreement, but you know that you have a little bit of bargaining power because the seller wants you to buy their property. If you're in a scenario where the property market is thriving and you've got two people making a bid on a property or three people making a bid on a property, that's when you start to see them go for more. And in certain parts of the property market, not all parts of the property market, but certain parts of the property market, mainly the sort of larger family home, detached house or large semi kind of thing, particularly, I think, in the more affluent pockets of the country. And by that, I don't just mean Southeast. I also mean, you know, the in-demand bits all around the country are selling like hotcakes. They are, you know, buyers are very, very interested. Sellers are putting their properties on the market, asking a little bit more rather than what everybody thought they'd have to be doing after the coronavirus freeze, of asking a little bit less. And they're getting maybe one or two people who are interested. So people are feeling that this is an asking price market. It's a market where you have to pay the asking price, not one where you can go in and get a property for 10 or 5% less. But if you're going up against someone else, maybe they've offered the asking price as well, and you end up being chipped up, and you could get chipped up by 5,000, 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. You can find places going for considerably more than asking price. I've seen it happen before where you get places go for 50 above. And it all depends for people on how much they want that property. The problem is people can get an emotional attachment to the property just from the point of where they've decided to put an offer in. An agent will always tell you the moment someone has actually decided to put an offer in on a property, for most people, they develop some kind of emotional attachment with it, that they now want that property. So they've moved on from it's just another property to look around. And so it's very easy to get tempted to go, okay, we'll pay a bit more, we'll pay a bit more, we'll pay a bit more. But the problem with any kind of bidding scenario or where you're bidding up prices is that you can end up overpaying, and even if the market just doesn't go anywhere, you might end up with a property that isn't really worth as much as you paid for it. And if the market falls, then you could end up with a property that's worth considerably less than you paid for it. But how long are you going to live there? You know, it's not a speculative thing. If you're going to be there for 5-10 years, if it's going to be your forever home and you really, really want that property, maybe it is worth paying a little bit more for it.
It just seems unusual when we talk about overpaying something, because so many of us, and the advice we've always seemed to give in the past, is chance your arm a little bit and ask for a little bit off. I mean, the last time we really spoke about this, it was like, yeah, 5-10%, get it off. But apparently, while most of us are doing that, Lee, a fair few sellers are sticking their fingers in their ears, la, 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 no. And by the way you've described this, it sounds like they can get away with that and sell it for, well, more.
Well, I think there's some interesting stats that have come out in the last sort of few weeks as well, Georgie, actually, that there's some stats here that show that the average home is achieving a record 98.6% of the asking price. So that's massive. You know, if houses are priced correctly, they're selling for the asking price. You know, usually, as you say, we'd say 5-10% down, you know, offer 5-10% less, chance you are, and see what happens. There's an example in this story from an estate agent, Duncan Young of Sanderson and Young, who's based up in the Northeast. He had 40 viewings and received 28 offers on a £575,000 4-bedroom semi-detached home in Northumberland. Wow. And it sold, he claims it sold for well above the asking price. Less than a month on the market. And he's saying, you know, coastline, villages, they're seeing huge increases in demand of interest, potentially because people are looking to move out of cities. We've had all of that argument already before. But what that kind of says at the moment is that it is a bit of a seller's market. And we had some stats this week from Rightmove saying that just a third of homes that are technically overpriced. Now, how you technically say a home is overpriced is a little bit of a tricky kind of thing to, you know, transcribe and to really pick down, but one third of homes that are sort of claimed to be overpriced that don't sell straight away, two-thirds that are priced correctly sell and sell much quicker. So I think that's all quite interesting data and stats that are coming out at the moment. And I joked around in the first little bit saying, you know, sellers are looking to pump up the price, and I think actually a few sellers will do this. They will go, do you know what, I'm going to put it for 10% over what the estate agent says recommends, or I've seen this house down the street here has gone for this amount, I reckon I could probably get a little bit more than that, and price that accordingly. But buyers are pretty smart usually, Georgie. Most buyers will do their homework. They will have a look at, you know, one of the key things is how long has this property been for sale for? You can get all of this kind of data now quite easily online, places like Zoopla and Rightmove and other property portals. You can have a look at the transaction history of a property. You know, how long ago was this property bought? What's happened since it was bought? What was the price that was paid? Has it been listed, you know, say last year and didn't sell, and now it's been listed again for the same price or more? You know, these are all sort of telltale signs that actually a seller's not quite achieving what it is that they want to achieve. I know Mr. Lab over here is a keen advocate of setting up property trackers, you know, having an alert system to know if you're looking to buy in a certain area, you can see when properties are going up, what they're selling for, what's happening, what are the trends. It's all about spotting those trends, isn't it, Georgie? And having a look at what's happening in your local area and knowing the market. And I think, I go back to buying a home sort of 4 or 5 years ago, and again, Simon just gave me such sound advice. I would say Simon gave me better advice than I probably got from an estate agent, from a solicitor, from anyone else, saying about it's all about, you know, the price you pay. You're always worried that you're paying at the top of the market. There's always that worry that you're going to go in negative equity. You know, we're in a different scenario, I would say, now to the financial crisis, in which people are way more aware of things like that. You know, the 100% mortgages aren't there. You know, you need probably now a 15% deposit, really. You can still get 10% deposit mortgages, but they're getting trickier and trickier to find. As long as you know what you're going to be doing in that home for probably 5 to 10 years, is it somewhere you're going to live? Is it big enough for you to have a family in if you're looking to have a family? Can you make do in a place like this, you know, a smaller place for 5 years and then think about moving on? I think if you're looking at buying somewhere to then flip in the next year or two, it's always, it doesn't matter when you buy, it'll be a kind of a bit of a crapshoot, really. You don't know what's going to happen. We don't know what's going to happen in the short term, long term. But one thing is certain, if you buy a home that can fit you for the next 5 to 10 years, you know, you don't have to worry. You don't have to have those sleepless nights worrying about what property prices are doing.
Simon, the guru, share some of that wisdom with the rest of us.
Well, I guess, that's the key thing, is just make sure that it will suit you and you'll be happy there for the next 5 years. Because if things move against you and you end up wanting to move but unable to move, then, you know, as long as you've got enough space and you can live there, you should be able to ride out, you know, a fall in the market. And if your home falls in value, so will all the other homes. So if you did need to move, you'll be able to buy another one cheaper. It's more the concern about negative equity, or you've got people at the moment, for example, who aren't in negative equity but would struggle to move because you can't get a 10% deposit mortgage. I mean, you know, for all I said earlier about, you know, if it's your dream home, maybe you pay a little bit more. Paying over the asking price is not my bag. I'm firmly of the trying to pay under the asking price school of thought. But, you know, that you've got to accept that that's not always possible. And it is a seller's market at the moment, I think, weirdly, which nobody, literally nobody expected. Everybody predicted big buyer's market this summer, with a very few exceptions of people who actually were laughed at the time when they said it was going to be a really busy summer for property. But in a sense, trying to buy in a buyer's market isn't that easy if you've got somewhere to sell as well. I moved home recently, and it, you know, before all of this stuff, and we struggled to sell our flat. Our flat was a great flat, had loads of space, had a garden, really well located, in a nice part of London and everything like that. And it was tough to sell it. I mean, there's always the argument, well, just cut the price. But a lot of the stuff last year, weirdly, when people were worrying about Brexit and things like that, it wasn't necessarily about the price. It was difficult to just get people around. People were unwilling to commit. They were unwilling to make offers. And it was, some of it was because they expected prices to go down. It's the kind of deflation thing, isn't it? It's like, why buy now when you think stuff will get cheaper in the future? And we've got the opposite at the moment. People are buying now because they think it's going to get more expensive in the future, but also they're buying now because they think they're going to save £15,000 from the stamp duty holiday if they're buying somewhere that costs more than £500,000. Obviously, there is the possibility that they might end up paying more than £15,000 more for the property now than they would have done. It could be a false economy. But in a sense, maybe it's easier if you've got somewhere to sell and you want to move to do it now, because it's going to be easier to sell your home and get a better price for your home. And yes, you're going up against other people for other homes. But it's not that, you know, even in a mini boom like this, it's not that super duper. There's lots of places I still see with reduced prices, having their asking prices cut because they went on for too much. There's lots of places still sitting around on the market. So I think maybe people just have to accept that if they're going to try and buy a house that everybody else is going to want to buy, the one that looks really amazing on Rightmove or Zoopla, you know, the really super duper house, they're going to find it tough, and they're going to end up in that kind of maybe above asking price or asking price scenario. But if they're looking for somewhere that the listing doesn't look that great, the photos aren't that good, maybe it needs something doing to it, something changing, but actually it's a good house, you know, and it's in the right location or something like that, you know, if you can look for the hidden gems, then you're probably going to find that you aren't going up against someone else or something that has been overpriced or something like that. Or so, I mean, there's an old saying that basically people focus on the stuff that you can change in properties and have it put them off, and they ignore the stuff that you can't change. So you can move a staircase, you can create a kitchen diner, you can extend, you can maybe convert a loft, you can move the kitchen, you can do all these other things, but you can't get a bigger garden. It's highly unlikely you can get a bigger garden unless you can find some willing landowner to sell you some more land. You can't move a property. The things that you cannot physically change about a property, people sort of ignore a bit, and they focus too much on, oh, I did like that one, but the staircase was in the wrong place. Mm. It's like, but that's putting everybody else off. So maybe, you know, consider those. And in terms of making an offer, if you want to get an offer accepted, you need to make the seller think that you are a good buyer. So you need to do a couple of things before you put in your low offer. You need a mortgage decision in principle. Get that lined up, shows you're serious. The money that you've got for a deposit, you've got that in place. Have maybe even offer to show bank statements that prove that you've got that money there. Have your house on the market. Ideally, you've got an offer accepted, or you don't even have somewhere to sell. That's the golden one. The cash buyer is the golden one. But it, just having your house on the market, people will take your offer much more seriously. If you've got an offer, they'll definitely take it more seriously. Talk to the estate agent, make the estate agent your friend. Do not hide behind property portals and emails. Don't go around the house and just sort of ignore the estate agent. You want to convince that estate agent that you are a really good prospect, because you want that estate agent to convince the seller that you are a really good prospect and that they should accept your offer. And if you are a really good prospect, people will sometimes accept a lower offer from you than they would from someone else. You know, you might get it for someone might have offered $5,000 more than you, but that seller might think, right, this person is definitely going to go through with it. They've got all their ducks in a row. They're all lined up to do it. Whereas that other person, they seem a bit shaky and I want to get moving. And then go in low if you want to. Mm. Kind of sound the agent out a bit. And, you know, don't be afraid about offending the seller with a low offer. You can always go up and, you know, a cheeky offer is a cheeky offer. But do sound the agent out a bit, because the agent will probably give you a little bit of a hint about whether they are the kind of person who's going to get offended if you go in really low. But go in low and you can negotiate up. Don't go in high and then try to negotiate down. That's very, very difficult to do. And, you know, don't get carried away as well. Have your what would I pay for this? What is this house worth to me? And what a house is worth to you is totally different to what a house is worth to someone else. And it might be worth an extra 10 grand to you. It might be worth an extra 10 grand to someone else, but not to you. And if you don't get it, that's life. Move on. You know what? It wasn't meant to be, and life will deliver you another property that will be just as great, and you move into it and you'll love it.
Exactly.
And don't panic about the stamp duty holiday as well. There's a lot of people really, really going, well, we must get in before the end of it. We must get in before the end of it. Widespread predictions that what's happening is a mini boom at the moment. Everyone's rushing to beat the stamp duty holiday. And what normally happens, if that deadline does come and the stamp duty holiday is removed, what normally happens is there is a lull after it, and then you can
house prices fall anyway, and you probably would have saved the money that you thought you would have theoretically saved had you got the stamp duty holiday. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that kind of thing. I mean, you can't guarantee it. Who knows? No,
of course not. Could go even lower.
It's weird. It's just before we stop on the whole property stuff, it is weird what's going on. There is a lot of unanswered questions about why is there this sudden surge in interest in moving home after lockdown. Lots of people talk about pent-up demand.
There's a lot of reasons that people are giving, but there doesn't seem to be one.
Other people say, well, what is this pent-up demand? You know, if people were going to move, they were going to move. But it is. I know a handful of people who had given no indication that they were thinking of moving, who've decided to move. I don't know. I think it's maybe it's a lockdown thing. Maybe it's the people being in their houses. Maybe it's the people just going, do you know what? Actually, I do fancy that change of scenery. But I do think there has been a bit of people putting stuff off because of the whole Brexit thing. And then unbelievably, something much worse has happened and people have gone, oh, you know what? I'll move. It is a very strange phenomenon that's going on at the moment.
So you mentioned Brexit there, and people say, why did you vote for Brexit or whatever? I think there's many different reasons why people do many different things. But as someone who's speaking, who had no plans to leave, I actually signed to stay even longer where I am at the moment. No plans whatsoever. And now I find myself moving. I mean, and I spoke to a colleague of mine as well, who's exactly the same position. We're not thinking about it before. I don't know what it is. I think personally for me, and I can only speak personally, it is the idea, if you're in an expensive area, perhaps a city, one, you're probably not getting value for money, or you think you're not with the space. And lockdown has proved to us how lovely space is and how grateful we are to have some space to get out. But also it's very expensive in certain areas. I can understand if you're living in London or a big city where you feel like you're overpaying for what you're getting, why not look a little bit further afield? And you can get, for half price effectively, you're getting more than what you could get where you currently are. And I don't see this situation changing anytime soon. I think it's obviously different for people who have to be in an area because they have to work there and they have to go to work. But if you are one of the, and I use this loosely, lucky ones who can work from home, because I do think there's value to be had from going into the office and seeing your colleagues, then I can absolutely understand why, if you're not going to go in any time in the foreseeable future into, say, London, why would you live in the outskirts or in London? Lee?
Well, this is, I think, a phenomenon that you're touching on, Georgie, and you're totally right. I was having this conversation this morning with my wife, with some of our friends. They live in a commuter town, you know, and he works up in London. He's been told that his job will now be permanently remote. He's worked at this place for 2 decades, you know, so it's completely gone. The office in the city is gone, and he'll be able to work remotely. And they've gone, do you know what? We don't need to live in this town with this train station. We can go and live out in a stick somewhere. And they've had an offer accepted on a nice house, sort of really in the middle of nowhere, that they would never have considered before because it didn't have train links. And I think there's going to be quite a lot of that kind of going on. A lot of people will move and go, well, I need to be 5-10 minute walk to the station if you're commuting into the city or commuting somewhere. I don't know how much more of that there's going to be. You know, I'm still getting the train into work and it's still quiet. And I wonder how many other businesses have gone, you know, don't need to come back into the office. You know, it's all be remote working or at least partly remote working. So if it goes flexible, okay, you need to go into your office 2 times a week, but you can kind of make do with that. And I think that is actually influencing people as well, thinking, yeah, don't need to be here. And it's like you were saying, you don't need to be in that expensive flat in the middle of the city anymore, because potentially a lot of what you're doing now is remote. And I think there's a lot of that going on.
I'm not in the middle of the city. That makes me sound like I'm really super rich, Lee. I'm out in the outskirts, you know.
Well, if you do want to live in the middle of the city and you do want to rent somewhere, it's getting cheaper. Rents are coming down. There's a lot of places seeing rents reduced in London at the moment and in really city centres. Yeah, well, it's still really expensive, but it's not as expensive as it was. Like, if you ever did really want to live right smack bang in the middle of London, now would, and rent somewhere to do it, now would be the time to do it, I think, because that is definitely a buyer's market in the sense of the renter being the buyer at the moment.
I have to say, not to ask, and this is a little bit off topic, and I'm sort of wondering if I'm going to regret asking what this might all mean with a lot of people who are thinking, yeah, it's fine, I'm gonna work from home, because there's obviously a reason that people thought they needed to live near where they worked or near the train station. Are we not just slightly overreacting, acting a little bit too quickly, going to find ourselves stuck in the middle of a country thinking, oh my god, now that we're going to open up and I have to get back to work, I've got a 4-hour travel ahead of me? Or could this, and this is where I really expand this out, could this be exactly what, and I think about George Osborne but others, have been really wanting in terms of building up other areas of the country, this northern powerhouse? And actually you're getting a lot of probably city Londoners thinking, sod it, I'm going to go up to, I don't know, wherever, Skipton, you know, and living there. And actually we're going to be building up the economies in these areas. That's a nice simple question for you. Who wants to take that?
Ideally, yes. Distance is less important.
I should say you're both nodding along when I was warning about people moving out and finding themselves stuck. So you were both agreeing that that could be the future.
I'd be very wary about moving to the middle of nowhere on the basis that I don't have to go into the office. There's a lot, you hear a lot of talk of that. Oh yeah, people are like, you know, the commute can extend now. It used to be people were happy to commute for an hour. Now they can make it 2.5 hours because they don't have to go into the office. So they only have to do it like once a week. It's like, yeah. And when your work turns round in a year's time and says it wants you back in the office 5 days, brilliant. You're spending 5 hours a day commuting or you're looking for a new job. So I would be very wary about some of the more sort of flight of fancy type stuff you read in the property fluff articles. However, I do think that it has proven that people can work from home, people who can work from home, can work from home on a large scale to companies. One of the things holding companies back was, could they manage those people? Could those people still deliver? And they didn't want to try it because it's very difficult to experiment with that stuff. And you also, it's disruptive, and then you've got to get people back in, and you know, you could just cause yourself all kinds of problems. Well, they just had to do it. Tech as well. You've got to buy people laptops and set people up and all these other things. That's expensive. So it puts companies off a large scale. Let's experiment with distance working, working from home. Well, they had to do it. Can you manage those people? All of those other things. They just had to do it. So we have had this gigantic experiment in the world of work, of working from home versus offices. And it's not thrown up that working from home is the be all and end all. What we've actually discovered is that working from home is great, but being in the office and seeing your colleagues and getting the creative spark and that kind of serendipitous moment and everything else like that, it is also really, really important. And there's a balance to be found. But I do think it has exposed to a lot of companies that it is possible for people to do it 2-3 days a week, that they probably need them in the office a bit less. And that should theoretically enable people to live in different parts of the country and work for, you know, for businesses that are in other parts of the country. It should theoretically spread the wealth around. It should loosen the grip of the London commuter belt and the capital. And that would be a good thing. You know, we have this north-south divide. We even have a north-south divide in terms of the the successful cities and the draw they have on the areas around them. They don't have the same draw on the areas around them as London does on its commuter belt. And I think that that is something that will play out. My big worry is that whilst all this is happening, the government has come up with another algorithm. And the algorithm that the government has is to do with planning and building new homes. And central to the government's algorithm on planning and building new homes is the idea that the sole cause of, or pretty much the sole cause of high house prices is a lack of supply of housing. So in areas where there is a larger gap between wages and house prices, the algorithm will calculate this and it will say that those areas have to have more houses. In areas where there is a lower gap, it will say they need less houses. And then they're going to do this zoning thing, and then they're going to try and impose these targets on the local areas. Now, this is bad news for people who live in the southeast of England and don't want to see a load more houses and their towns just sprawl and sprawl and sprawl, because the some of the popular towns are going to be told they need to build many, many more houses. And in the north, some of the areas where there is house building going on are going to be told that they have to build less. But the problem is the algorithm is built on something that is discredited to an extent. The Bank of England itself has put out a paper saying actually most of the growth in house prices over the past couple of decades can be put down to the supply of cheap credit. The more cheap credit you get, the more house prices go up. And the supply of property is a factor, but it's been a smaller factor over the last couple of decades than the cheap money era. So the government's cooked up an algorithm and is going to impose these planning laws on the country based on something that most people within the property world and most economists and the Bank of England itself says isn't actually true. And it's going to do that at the same time as we're theoretically enabling more people to live further away from those cities, thus loosening even more the house price inflation effect of London on the commuter belt. So, I mean, will they stop or will they just push this thing through? Who knows? But there's an issue here and I think it gets overblown, but anybody who objects to this gets labeled a NIMBY. But I've said this before, looking after your backyard doesn't make you a NIMBY. But there's a lot of thinking in the sort of people who know kind of world that, well, if you just object to this stuff, you're a NIMBY. If you don't want houses built on the fields around you, you're just a NIMBY. Maybe it's that people like the fields around them. And in lockdown, I tell you what, you've noticed an awful lot more people enjoying the countryside around their towns. Maybe around
other people's towns, because that's what NIMBY is. It's saying, I don't want people building on my town, but it's all right, you can build over there. And now I'm thinking, actually, no.
But maybe some of these towns are big enough already. Maybe they've got to the point where they're big enough already. Maybe we should create new towns, not try to keep like making these ones sprawl. But the government's plan at the moment is just to keep sprawling those towns. And personally, you know, I don't think that's the right way forward.
Lee, before we move on, just wrap up your initial thoughts or your thoughts about what we've been discussing.
I was nodding along both to you and Simon. First of all, I was nodding along because of the person I was speaking about who's moving to the sticks. I said exactly the same thing. What if that person, the employer, actually does turn around next year and go, oh no, actually we've changed our mind, you're coming back into the office, or unfortunately loses his job and has to find another job and all of the jobs that he applies for in the office. That was my sort of sensible hat. And I was nodding along to Simon there, because this is a conversation I'm sure we've had a few times on the podcast about NIMBYs and not building, you know, these sprawling towns. I live in one of these towns where just new builds just keep getting thrown up left, right and centre. And with it, the infrastructure just doesn't go up alongside it. So already in a kind of gridlocked town, a real sort of commuter town for London. But car use definitely in the last sort of month or two has been way higher than I can ever remember here. It's just like gridlock. And these homes, I think there's about 1,000 homes going up about 5 minutes from my house here. All these lovely green fields that you can currently walk across, all getting just built over. But there's no other main trunk road or anything that's going alongside it. I don't even think there's a plan for another school or any other facilities to go with it that I've seen in the planning. So it's not about... It's not being a NIMBY. It's more of a kind of... I'm living here and now it's a bit of a concern about well, how much is too much, you know, extra homes? And as Simon says, I don't understand why we just don't. There was this whole thing about building new garden towns. What's happened with that? And why isn't that more of the focus? I think if you build a town from scratch somewhere, you know, you like to think we've learned lessons from the past. A lot of towns, a lot of cities and things are built around hundreds of years old kind of layouts and plans and things. We could surely build smarter and better in a new town, and greener as well. Yeah. You know, but whether these things ever happen, it's too sensible, I think, Georgie.
Yeah. All right. Well, look, before we put this to bed, I'll say one thing that may not be sensible. Look, if you are thinking of moving away and buying away, maybe look at renting for a year in one place, seeing how the lay of the land is before you fully commit to that sort of that lifestyle. And you may not even like it. You may think, oh god, it's blooming boring, isn't it? So anyway, that was my little tip for the day. But lockdown, it seems, isn't all about dreaming of country living and banana bread making. No, it seems it's made an army of keen traders in company shares, Simon, which is rather interesting, as funds and trusts are often the go-to for the beginner investor. So look, what's all this being put down to? You know, where's the evidence of all of this? And are we any good at it?
Rise of the lockdown trader. Yeah. What's it being put? What can it be put down to? I don't know. A number of different things. It's a phenomenon that is definitely been occurring in the US. We've talked about this before when we were talking about the US stock market being chased up, and the rise in, you know, sort of personal investors accounting for 20 to 25% of the volume of trading. There's some very, very high profile US companies that have done very, very well after the coronavirus crash market bottomed out. And we probably don't need to list them, but the Teslas, the Amazons, the Apples of this world. And people have been buying the shares, investing directly into the shares. It's fueled in America by some of the free trading apps. Robinhood is the famous one, the Robinhood effect. But also by the fact these shares have been going up lots. And it's like, are they investing or are they just speculating? Are they just chasing gains? Do a lot of these people have any intention of holding those Tesla shares still in 5 years' time? I would say probably not. Mm-hmm. But it's also happening here as well. Anecdotally, I've been hearing more talk of people saying, oh, I've been getting into the stock market, you know, while I was at home on lockdown. You know, some people were furloughed, some people just couldn't work. And they were like, yeah, I've been, you know, buying, selling some shares and I've been doing all right. So we looked into this. We spoke to the major platforms. We spoke to some of the smaller free trading apps that you've got here, Free Trade and eToro. And they said, yeah, we've got more people buying shares. So basically, and we've got more people signing up. So eToro, for example, said it had a big uptick in new UK registrants over lockdown, a 420% increase in the number of open stock trades from January to June compared to the same period in 2019. Now, obviously, some of that is the platform being more successful, but Interactive Investor, trades in shares were up 119% year on year between the 1st of April and 31st of August. The trades at AJ Bell were much higher. Across the board, we saw this. Hargreaves Lansdowne, DIY investing giant, 221% rise in the number of trades between 24th of March and 30th of June. And told us that although there'd been an increase in selling, 183%, clients were more interested in buying, with shares purchased up 258%. Free Trade said 26% increase in order volume. And also, interestingly, the new people getting involved in this are younger. Between March and September, Free Trade saw an 80% increase in its total customers. The biggest proportion were aged 18 to 25 at 27% and 26 to 35 at 42%. Now, what's interesting is that buying and selling shares, but lots of people like to invest directly in shares in this country. Lots of This Is Money readers like to invest directly in shares, but it tends to be an older generation. It skews towards them. It tends to be more the kind of people who started investing when you still phoned up your stockbroker or you had a personal financial advisor and all that kind of stuff. And they've continued to buy and sell shares. Or it's the people who were really, really interested in the stock market and it's a bit of a hobby. A lot of the rest of the people, the newer generation of investors, have tended to buy funds because it's easy. maybe investment trusts if they're quite interested. But the party to be at in recent years has been ETFs, exchange-traded funds. Seems that the party to be at has totally changed around, and it's now buying individual shares. There's an interesting gap between the established DIY investment platform players and the free trade app, free trading apps. And with the established players, it tends to be the big UK brand names. With the free trading apps, people are buying more of the big US shares. So the most popular being Tesla, for some reason, probably because it's a proper stock market roller coaster. But then we come back to the question that I asked at the beginning of this is, are these people investing or are they speculating? I think there's a lot of speculating going on. It's trading more than it is investing. But will that whet people's appetites to become long-term investors?
And that was the subject of your
column. Yeah. And I don't know. I think maybe it will. I think you get people in. It's a bit of a gateway. They get interested, and it won't just be a passing fad. I think people are engaging with their money. Yes, they might be, you know, gambling a little bit on it, and some of them are probably going to lose. Some of them have probably done very well, and then will probably do very, very badly when the market takes a tumble again. But the more people you can get interested in buying and selling shares and taking a stake in a company, if you can then convert them into, you know, patient owners, long-term thinkers, proper investors, then that's a good thing. And I think what we also need, though, is we need a better system of share ownership in this country, because most people do it through platforms nowadays as nominee, through a nominee account. And actually, it's the platform that holds the shares, not you. And there's a big push from some of the share organizations like ShareSoc and people like that to get proper digital share ownership. So you don't have this nominee system, which is, in all honesty, not a great system. It's enabled people to buy and sell shares much more cheaply and much more easily than they once could. But it's not a great system. And then you want to try and engage people with those companies, like try and get them to, you know, vote at shareholder meetings and do all these other things. I'm going to be optimistic on it. Some others are not so optimistic. I tweeted about this yesterday, and Mark Dampier, formerly of Hargreaves Lansdown, tweeted me back. He was like, no, they're not going to become long-term investors. You know, but I don't know. I'm going to try and be a bit more optimistic.
Well, I'm sort of Lee a bit with Simon. I think there's also something to be said about savings rates at the moment and people wanting to actively get a little bit more involved. It's probably never been so easy to get involved in investing if you're a newbie, because it's, well, you just read a couple of your articles and then you're on your way, aren't you? But the low savings rates on offer, I want to talk about that, Lee, because inflation dropped. I just think of the Warren Buffett quote about when the tide goes out, you see you swimming naked. It's a bit like that. The rates have dropped so low, you've seen absolute the paucity of offers from biggest banks on decent savings. What is it? 11 now offer over 0.2%. What?
Exactly, Georgia. That exact phrase came into my mind as well. It's really
good, because I thought I just lost the plot then.
No, this drop of inflation to 0.2% from 1%, which was driven by eat outs and help out and a drop in VAT, has basically really exposed Britain's big banks. Again, not that they needed further exposing over the low savings rates that they're offering, but this really, really, really exposes it, because at 0.2%, it just shows that, you know, so few big banks are offering over that amount to savers, which is quite incredible, really. I mean, that is an incredibly low rate of inflation to not be able to beat. And 11 out of 661 inflation beating accounts come from the big seven names. 11, that's like 1% of all savings. And we're not just talking about easy access here. We're talking about fixed rate bonds. We're talking about fixed rate ISAs. We're talking about products that would traditionally have higher rates. No. And there's just one easy access account offered by Nationwide Building Society that beats 0.2% from the bigger names, you know, out of sort of 80-odd accounts. It's absolutely incredible. But, Georgie, the thing is with this, and I'm sure we've discussed this in recent weeks, big banks are seeing an absolute influx of cash from savers. And these very same banks that we're talking about that are offering, you know, non-inflation-beating accounts at 0.2% are seeing tens of billions of pounds flood in this year into said accounts, because, namely, People have been able to save a little bit more. And my other theory is people just want the ease. They just want to be able to access their funds from where they have their current account, have it all under one roof and go, what's the point of chasing 0.8%? Okay, I'm getting paid 0.1%. What does that work out on 10 grand? Oh, well, what's the point of moving around? And there's a lot of that going on. They're talking about the savers inertia, and I can totally understand it. And we even had the boss of, well, not the boss, we had someone from TSB saying in recent weeks that savers just aren't interested in interest rates at the moment. Just got no, they're not chasing rates. They've got no interest. You know, they want better customer service, and they just want to know that their money's safe.
There's not a lot to chase, though, is there?
It's not a lot to chase. Well, but you say that though. But if you start to say that you can get a rate that's ninefold, you know, over what's been offered by your bank, and you start putting it into that perspective, it does sound actually like, well, okay, 0.1%, or I could get 1%. Now, look, 1% on your savings is not ideal. Yes, we wish we were, you know, back in the past where savings rates were higher than what they are on offer at the moment. But, you know, we're staring down the barrel of potential negative interest rates to the Bank of England, which has been mentioned this week, which could be to further detriment to savers, could mean negative interest rates, savings rates. We've had this argument before that this could happen. Banks start charging you for having your cash there. I could totally see a scenario in which that happens, because a lot of savers just simply won't move this historic money that's been floating around in there, and they'll probably just see it as a way of making a bit more money during the pandemic. I wouldn't be surprised, Georgie. You know, don't be shocked to see negative interest rates and savings rates come into play at some point in the coming months. But for me, it's really hard to tell someone if they've got £1,000 or between £1,000 and £10,000 of interest to move their 0.1% account to a 1% account. You know, what you're talking about hardly any benefit financially from it, and a whole lot of paperwork and moving around and potentially having to have another set of login details. All of these sort of things are like hurdles that a lot of people are simply just going, no, what's the point for an interest that might get me a couple of flat whites or something? Do you know what I mean? And that's why, potentially, that is why people have been turning their attentions a little bit to investing. Simon and I were talking yesterday, some interesting research from the States, basically saying that a lot of people have moved into buying individual shares. We saw Tesla and the likes, you know, shoot up this year because they were no longer able to gamble on sports. They weren't able to put their money onto sports betting. And the other bit was, you know, they've had these $1,200 checks come in, and a lot of people have decided to use those checks given by the government to invest and just to take a punt on some stocks and shares. And you know, a lot of that you can then start going, and this Robin Hood effect that Simon wrote about in his column, you know, this popular trading app in America that was meant to launch it here, but they've decided not to launch here, has made it easier than ever for especially younger people who probably think it's all belt and braces and, you know, pinstripe suits, or, you know, people shouting at a stock exchange, all that kind of stuff. Well, it's just now you can just do this. I could have my phone, I could set up, download an app, and within 2 minutes I could be putting money into you know, whatever share I want to buy, probably from around the world. Again, this other thing, I wrote this story for the Consumer Trends column back in April about Nintendo and Nintendo Switch consoles and how they were like the must-buy thing of lockdown. And I was talking about the Nintendo share price in there, and it was like lagging some, you know, its highest point was some point in the late 90s. Well, since that, I wrote that 5 months ago, it shot up way beyond record highs because younger people in America have been invested in Nintendo because they recognize the name of the brand, they like the brand, and they've just been pumping money into it, you know, and that's what's been going on. And I think it is a really fascinating topic, this whole thing about investing and what's happening with younger people.
All right, well, we're going to put that, as fascinating as it is. Please, if you have any views, do get in contact with us and tell us. But I'm going to put that to one side because I'm conscious my sort of existential questioning earlier has probably taken us down a very long podcast path. So, but there are a couple of topics that I still want to address before I let you go. And the first one is the good news for businesses, those who've been forced to shut down as a result of the coronavirus pandemic. Many thought they had insurance. Insurers said, but the FCA took them to court or brought a test case in front of the High Court earlier this year, and we've got the judgment, and the insurers have been told you need to pay out. However, not quite the great victory in the fact that a lot of businesses may have to wait a fair while, and by which stage, well, many could fold by that. So Simon, just really quickly, if you would like, what's a test case mean anyway? And what's this one about?
So this erupted as Britain went into lockdown and businesses were told to shut their doors, particularly hospitality businesses. And some of them checked their insurance policies or knew that they had insurance policies that covered them for pandemics. And so, understandably, they contacted their insurers and said, this insurance policy that I've been paying for, that's been costing me quite a bit of money, that covers me for a pandemic, I'd like you to pay out on it, because it what it covers is business interruption if you can't do business because of something. And the insurers turned around and went, doesn't cover this pandemic, sorry, it's not this kind of pandemic. People were obviously a bit upset. Well, it says pandemic, I've been paying through the nose for this. Yeah, but the government, it covers you for a pandemic, not for the government telling everybody that they have to shut down. So big row ensues, some very high profile insurers. FCA gets involved and says, right, we want to have a test case in the High Court. And it got some of the insurers together and it put forward this test case. And the court ruled on a representative sample of 17 policy wordings used by 16 insurers. And the judgment found that most, though not all, of the disease clauses in the sample did provide cover. So these insurers should be paying out. It clarified that the COVID-19 pandemic and the government and the public response were a single cause of the covered loss, which is a key requirement for claims to be paid, even if the policy provides cover. And so now these insurers have to pay up. Or do they have to pay up? Well, it's not quite so cut and dry, is it, with insurance? So it's going to rumble on for a while people try to get this ruling to make sure that their insurers do pay out. I mean, insurers are on the hook for hundreds of millions of pounds. Hiscox, for example, expects to have to pay out 100 million. Now, Hiscox is an interesting one, because Hiscox's insurance policies have always been considered very good insurance. You pay for it, it's expensive, but it's very good insurance. They'll insure you for the stuff that other people won't, kind of reputation. And, you know, that it's dented that reputation, certainly for Hiscox, but also for other insurers. And the ABI has said, well, this is very complicated. The insurance body and everything like that, it's very complicated. We're not entirely sure everybody's got to pay out and everything like that. But it would be really nice to just see these insurers go, okay, do you know what? We did sell you insurance that covered a pandemic. There was a pandemic. Nobody expected it. Yes, it's been unprecedented, to use the word of the year. But we are going to pay you out because you did have pandemic cover. And now there's been a test case and it said that you should get paid out. So they should just pay up, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah. Then I'm not the finance director of an insurer.
No, you're not. But given that people in the High Court have said they should, they probably should. We're going to move on. Lee, it's been a while since we've had a good coin story. Yep, you're fist pumping, you're praying, you're just thinking, yeah. Often, though, it's about discovering a rare coin that's worth loads of money. But are we going to get to a stage, Lee, soon where every coin's going to be a rare coin? Because we got the news, lovely article by George, by the way, well done, that the Royal Mint is set to go more than a decade without producing any new 2p or £2 coins. We know, we hear it a lot about cash usage going down, and that obviously prompts many an article about, is this the death of cash? But why this decision, Lee?
Well, people are just not using cash anywhere near as much as they were before, Georgie. So we've got these stats here showing that in 2017, it was the first time the Royal Mint hadn't made any 1p or 2p coins. First time since 1972 that it hadn't made 1p coins, and the first time since 1984, which I think is absolutely incredible. And actually, what's going to happen now, between now and probably the next 10 years, is they've got such a surplus of 2p and £2 coins, they're just not going to need to make any more. And the whole reason for that is our reduced cash usage. So these National Audit Office figures show that the number of coins that the Royal Mint's making, which I've visited, by the way, in Wales. And again, I'm sure mm-hmm. this podcast passed, but it's a great place to visit, a lovely museum and everything. We're definitely worth a little trip. It fell two-thirds between 2011 and this year. Two-thirds, it's making two-thirds less coins. And this is before the pandemic and all the coronavirus, you know, push towards contactless bites. At the start of the decade, it 1.1 billion coins it made for the UK, and that dropped to 383 million. And it comes as a quarter of less than a quarter of all payments now are made by cash. And that was, again, last year. So this time next year, when we're looking back on what happened during the coronavirus pandemic, I'm pretty certain that is going to have dropped hugely. Now, before I wade into this story, and a little story I want to tell you from what happened to me last week, I'm a massive advocate of both card use and cash use. I think consumer choice is key. I think people should be able to use whichever payment choice that they want to do. We shouldn't be pushed towards one or the other. I think, you know, people should be able to do what they want. Now, I went to Park in my local town last week, Georgie, and this is where I get a little bit worried about this whole domination with technology. I went to pay the car park with the app because I didn't have much change on me, and the app was down. I checked on social media, the app was down. Everyone couldn't pay for car parking with a certain company. The phone line was jammed. There was no way of paying basically with my phone. Luckily, I managed to scramble together 60 pence. There was a float, you know, you just have like the floating change around the car. I managed to get 60p in half an hour. I thought, what I do, I'll withdraw some cash. I'll go and buy a Costa coffee, support the local economy, get some change, go and pay for the parking. So that's what I do. Get some cash out, go into Costa, queue, order my coffee. I go to pay, get a £10 note. I need to pay by cash because I need change for the car park. No. Can't take that. Okay, well, I need to pay by cash, you know, because I need to pay for the car park. No, we're not accepting cash. We haven't got any float. We're not accepting cash. Everyone's got a bank account. Pay by your card. And that's when I just was like, well, actually, not everyone does have a bank account. There's more than a million people in this country that don't have a bank account. So how are they meant to be paying for coffees here? So anyway, I just got a bit annoyed. I walked out of the shop, didn't pay for the coffee. I went to a market trader. He was happy to take my £10 note, pound for some bleach. Went back to the car park. Now, I got back to the car park, Georgie, and I thought to myself, had I been a bit of an idiot there? Had I sort of like, you know, got on my high horse and just been like, you know, this is a pandemic. And I thought, do you know what? I was probably I wasn't rude, but I was probably a slight bit harsh about this. I get back. There's a lady with a pram, screaming baby, next to the parking point to pay. You don't have change for a tenner, she asked me. Well, no, I've had to do exactly the same thing. She's got speakerphone onto this company where she's trying to pay, and it's all, and this kid is just kicking off. And I said, look, how much hours do you need? Well, she was going to the doctor's surgery, which is also where the paid car park is for. And she said, oh, I just need like, you know, a couple of hours. I don't know. I was like, okay. And I just paid for it. I did it, a couple of quid. Yeah, well, I'm not a hero, George. I'm definitely not one.
You counterbalance the negative.
Exactly. I decided that the £2 wasn't going to Costa, but the £2 should go to this lady who needed it more. And it just goes to show the technology, though. My whole point of this is the technology aspect of always relying on apps and cards and all that kind of thing. It can fail. Of course, it could fail when you're trying to put change into a coin machine for a car park, but there's usually more than one point. And I just think, you know, we are going down a route at the moment where if we don't start trying to pay a little bit more by cash and having a blend and a balance of how we pay, you know, we could be going really down to a cashless Britain route. And actually, just to finish this story off, I was meeting my mum in the town, and she'd been in a kind of market stall bit, and the owner of one of the stalls in there actually was refusing card. And believed that the whole of coronavirus was a global conspiracy and was only taking cash and was quite proud of it. And equally, that's just not the way forward, Georgie. You know, a blend of both, accept both. That's my opinion.
And a good one it is too. And Lee, you're a little hero, aren't you? You're a little hero.
No.
Remember? No. Okay, fair enough. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything that you would like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all the podcasts past and join in the debate and read comments. And if you've got any ideas where all of Britain's missing cash has gone, a question that is puzzling luminaries such as the Bank of England and the Royal Mint, who have said that they're just not quite sure where all this money has got to, then do fill us in. And also, if you are tempted to do a bit of lockdown share trading, I should have shamelessly plugged this earlier. I'm shamelessly plugging it now, which is a real shame because people will probably have stopped listening by this point. Come play our share picking game. Try and win £15,000. You don't have to put any money in. There's no risk. This is money.co.uk/game.
Of course not. Our listeners are loyal, Simon. They are hanging on your every word right until the very end. So yeah, do get involved in that. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. The This Is Money podcast is brought to you with Charles Stanley Direct. Open an account today and start saving for your future. Investment involves risk.